The basic modern history of abstract art is that it starts in the 19-teens, and typically it's credited to three pioneer painters, Kandinsky and Malevich in Russia, Mondrian in the Netherlands, each of whom abandoned conventional picture-making in different ways and then wrote manifestos about themselves and their ideas, and thus the canon and history was all set. But an exhibition now at the Guggenheim Museum in New York is completely overturning that truth universally acknowledged. The show is called Hilma auf Klint, Paintings for the Future, consisting of abstract paintings made starting in 1906 by a middle-aged Swedish woman, who until now almost nobody had ever heard of. All of the work on display is flabbergasting, and lots of it I absolutely loved, like pretty much everyone else does.
I felt like I could stand there and look at it all day and not be tired of it.
I'd seen reproductions of these before the show came, and I thought that they were going to be pretty small. And then just seeing the monumental size is really stunning. It's really beautiful.
The Auf Klint show has been topic A in the art world all season long. How did this artist invent radically abstract art before any of the famous artists, the men, who got all the credit? The answer is a great, complicated story, and Studio 360's Lauren Hansen set out to unravel that mystery of Hilma auf Klint. She started at the Guggenheim.
When you walk up the first ramp in the Guggenheim, the first series of paintings you see by Hilma auf Klint are called the 10 largest. They are 10 abstract paintings hung very closely together. They blanket a wall, basically end to end, in a side gallery. And they're huge, more than 10 feet tall.
And walking into that space and seeing those paintings was just transformative for me. You know, it was really like, oh my God.
Roberta Smith is the longtime art critic for the New York Times.
The thing that impressed me the most was this kind of mysterious thing called scale, you know, which is a combination of size and of a relationship of the parts to the whole. And her scale was so radical.
The paintings don't depict any one thing necessarily, although you can probably pick out some familiar shapes. There are floral patterns and spirals and circles and this loopy cursive. But they're very modern. It's almost hard to believe that they were made a century ago. They look like something that emerged out of a 1970s dream and would hang handsomely in an all-glass home in the Hollywood Hills.
The colors are very much not the colors that we think about and associate with the history of abstraction.
Micah Pollack is an art historian and professor.
Purple and green and orange.
Like dried tangerine skin. It just seemed very unfamiliar.
What's remarkable is that these massive abstract paintings were made in 1906 and 1907. In other words, at least 5 years before Kandinsky mansplained abstract art in his manifesto about his own abstract art, Hilma auf Klint was actually making abstract art, even if she wasn't tooting her own horn for doing so.
I'm not sure why it's a race and someone has to get there first, but yeah, it does look like she was there first.
To think that this triumvirate of Kandinsky, Mondrian, and Malevich was going to have a new member, and it was a woman, and she got there first, was just thunderous to me.
But who was this woman? Even for art experts, this likely probable founder of modern abstraction was a mystery.
I saw many, many exhibitions on modernism and that period, and I thought it's very unlikely I come across someone who is as important as Hilma auf Klint was. And so it really struck me that this artist was completely unknown to me.
Julia Voss is an art historian in Berlin who is now writing the first substantial biography on Hilma auf Klint. She says Hilma's story begins in 1862 in Stockholm, where she's born into a family of naval officers.
Her family were actually the makers of the big nautical charts of the Baltic Sea. And what you actually do is you make something that is hidden because it's underwater, you make it visible for other people. And I think that's very comparable to what she's doing. She also makes a world that is hidden to other people visible to them.
She attended the Royal Academy during the early years of when they let women into the Royal Academy.
Tracy Bashkoff is the curator of the Helma F. Klint exhibition at the Guggenheim.
She would have been trained as a traditional painter and done sort of classical drawing and painting exercises, making landscapes, portraits.
I mean, when she studied at the Academy, she got a gold medal for a history painting, which is absolutely extraordinary for a woman in the 1880s. So I think there would have been a career path there, but she wasn't interested. In 1906, she starts a completely new thing.
So, in 1906, Helma F. Klint begins a whole new artistic and professional venture, one that would be a total right turn from her strict academic education. But what's interesting is that the timing isn't coincidental. There is a lot going on at this moment. The turn of the 20th century was a time of rapid change and huge scientific, medical, and technological advances.
The telephone in 1876, right, with Alexander Graham Bell, and the radio was invented in 1894. The X-ray was invented in 1895.
The discovery of atoms and small particles opens up the idea that the world itself is made sort of more than just meets the eye.
And Helma doesn't shy away from this new world progress. She jumps right in, putting her academic artistic training to use. She gets work illustrating medical journals. But all of these scientific developments inspire Helma and many other artists and thinkers to start questioning other things about their world and the possibilities beyond it.
The 19th century, sort of, people were still very religious. So the idea that there is a higher sphere is kind of common to everyone, and every sort of the majority believes in it. Sort of the question only is, how can it be reached? And suddenly sort of science says, you know, we might be the ones. We might be the ones who can reach it. And that is fascinating not only for scientists, but also for artists.
If we can send a voice through a wire, or if we can see inside our bodies, which are made up of tiny particles.
If these things are possible, then maybe there are auras and some special people are able to see them. Maybe we could have spirit communicating with us telepathically and telling us what to paint.
Toward the end of the 19th century and well into the 20th, a whole spiritualism movement, fueled by the scientific discoveries of the day, starts to spread across Europe and America.
The spiritualist movement took off, and it became very popular in society, and there were regularly spiritualist events that took place, lectures and demonstrations that would be held in different towns and cities.
The main attraction at these events was contacting the dead. People held seances, conducted trances, sought out mediums who claimed they could tap into the spiritual world mentally or physically. Some of the most devout believers were those who lost a loved one. Mary Todd Lincoln famously organized a seance in the White House after the death of her son Willie. But spiritualism and the many branches that sprung from it had other famous enthusiasts, including writers like Victor Hugo and Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, and artists like Piet Mondrian, Vasily Kandinsky, and Helma F. Klint.
In 1880, that is when she's 18, her younger sister dies. Before, it might have been sort of curiosity, or it might have been sort of something you're interested in, but as soon as you have lost a person you want to be in touch with again, I think it becomes a kind of higher importance, and you get more attentive to everything that could point in the direction that it's possible to connect with the dead.
But that grief over her sister's death blossoms into a desire to communicate with a whole astral plane of spirit guides. In the late 1800s, Helma forms her own spiritualist group with four other women. They call themselves the Five, or De Femme. And this is actually something that a lot of women are doing at the time.
The spiritualist group was a place where women had quite a bit of agency, and women were regularly giving these lectures. The spiritualists were also associated with suffrage, in fact, and so the forming of her own spiritualist group, as well as being interested in these ideas, really clues her into a world where women had a voice in a different way than she may have been experiencing in other parts of her life.
I can only imagine how repressive it must have been for a single woman.
Rebecca Quaitman is an artist in New York. She goes by R.H. Quaitman. She created about 30 abstract paintings in response to Hilma's work that are also on view at the Guggenheim. The main focus of Quaitman's work here is a series of circle and square paintings. They're much more austere and cerebral in their minimalism than Hilma's, but scattered among the other paintings are references to her inspiration. A Swedish flag, a pair of swans, the use of gold, or the cover of one of Hilma's notebooks.
It's very interesting that the rise in popularity of spiritualism went hand in hand with feminism, basically, and that suddenly it was a way to have authority and a voice, because it wasn't your voice, it was this other voice speaking, which couldn't be questioned. So it must have been very freeing as a kind of trick, in a way, or a kind of method to speak.
Hilma and the Five meet often to communicate with a spiritual dimension. They make contact with four spirits, and they name them Gregor, Clemens, Amal Leal, and Ananda. They call them the High Masters. The Five receive messages from the High Masters using a method called automatic drawing. Think of a Ouija board, but with a pencil. One woman is the conduit, and she holds the drawing mechanism. The spirit guides her hand, creating shapes and sometimes letters on paper. And Hilma becomes one of the main conduits for recording these spiritual messages. Guggenheim curator Tracy Bashkoff.
It certainly sounds weirder to us and kooky today in a way that I think it didn't at the time. She is, in 1904, approached by one of the spirits that she is communicating with in her weekly group. And the spirit asks her if she would dedicate herself to the production of a group of paintings that would ultimately guide a viewer through a visionary experience.
Amal Leal presented me with a task, and I immediately said yes. The expectation was that I would dedicate a year to this task. In the end, it became the greatest work of my life.
I mean, I'm sorry, but I'm a non-believer. You know, I have to believe that all this stuff was made up.
Again, New York Times art critic Roberta Smith.
You know, I don't know. Maybe I'm going to get slammed for this, but I just think it's a fiction that enables the work to come out.
That work would be 193 paintings Hilma called Paintings for the Temple, and she made those between 1906 and 1915. They're made up of multiple series, which each have their own name, like The Ten Largest, that's one series. But there's also Primordial Chaos, The Swan, The Dove, The Seven-Pointed Star. The paintings within each group have a similar look, abstract generally, but with recognizable shapes like circles, squares, and pyramids, or images like tree-like structures and birds. Almost all of the work shares this wild palette of color that can range from soft pink pastels to shimmering golds and deep blood reds. But the paintings feel of a whole. They feel like they belong to each other. Hilma said the paintings at first came to her in this mediumistic manner through the spirits. But in those later years, her work was just inspired by those messages. But just the attempt by artists to do what Hillman was doing, to paint something non-representative, to evoke rather than show, was very much rejected by early 20th century society.
Any of the artists that were working at that time were going into uncharted territory, and Kandinsky's work was being thrown out of salons of even the most avant-garde artists for being too out there and too difficult to interpret.
Guggenheim curator Tracy Bashkoff.
Often the artists that were working in these early years of abstraction, their work angered the critics and the public because of the difficulty in understanding these canvases that didn't have any recognizable imagery in it.
When Hilma finishes the paintings for the temple in 1915, she's in her 50s. She tries again and again to get her work shown, but never gets the venue or the reception she believes it deserves.
She decides in the early 1930s that she will not spend any effort anymore on trying to show it, but that she should wait and should sort of hand her work on to the future, to the next generation. And that's where she puts down in all her notebooks that they cannot be shown for the next 20 years after her death.
When Hilma dies in 1944, she gives everything to her nephew. He sticks to her rule and puts everything away for 20 years. Then, in the 1960s, he sets up a foundation for her work. He gets help from an art historian to get it seen. But Hilma's paintings won't be shown in public until the 1980s. And even then, the future audience that Hilma was looking for, it still wasn't ready for her yet.
The reception was quite bad. I think that happens until the 19th, from the 80s through to the 90s. Actually, one critic calls it colored diagrams and says that she's, as a painter, she's just not anywhere close to Kandinsky.
All of Hilma's work is owned by the Hilma af Klint Foundation. It has never gone to auction, which means no galleries, no museums, or private collectors own it. And this means there are fewer opportunities for the public to see it.
The Hilma af Klint paintings so far cannot be bought. Kandinsky can be bought and could have been bought. And I guess the difference is that the museums have built their reputations on their collection. And it's kind of counterintuitive to them to argue for the relevance of a painter that could never be part of their collection. I think if she was on the market, she would be very expensive very soon and would have a big lobby to support her. And so I think it's even more outstanding that the Guggenheim Museum did this exhibition without any kind of gallery background or any financial backgrounds.
Decades of gender politics and the vagaries of art history and market forces may have kept Hilma af Klint out of the limelight, but now she's getting her due in the biggest of ways.
I still also find myself strength in looking at Hilma af Klint and how she dealt with what other people would have conceived as failure. She certainly was kind of disappointed that the reception wasn't bigger than it was, but she had a very strong confidence in the generations to come. I think this is maybe why a lot of young people also respond to her so strongly. She's the opposite of a kind of old grumpy person who says sort of, I'm misunderstood by my times and sort of, centuries ago, everything was better. She's a complete futurist. She believes sort of in the young generation to come, and she waits for us to look at it.
I love the idea that she was looking for an audience for this work and that the audience is at a future time, and perhaps we're that future time.
Perhaps we are, because here now, 75 years after Hilma af Klint died, is another artist working in another medium, conjuring up Hilma through music.
I wanted the piece to have a quasi-mystical vibe in places just to get that initial impression right off the bat, to have a sense of wit and fun, because there's so much fun in her artwork and the feeling of that whimsy and freedom.
Sarah Kirkland Snyder composed an original piece of classical music inspired by Hilma af Klint's work for the Guggenheim.
Early into my exploring, I came upon this letter that was, they're not sure whether she'd written it to herself or whether she'd taken it as dictation from one of the seances.
When you do not see an outer result, this must not discourage or tire you in your effort.
It seemed like a letter that one would write to oneself to remember that even in fallow periods of a creative life, there's growth even in tough times, and to stay strong and stay focused and have faith.
Just as invisible hands help and tend every plant on this green earth, so every budding sprout of goodness is tended and shaped and protected by invisible powers. And when the time comes, your eyes will open, and you too will see the beautiful plant that grew in secrecy, the product of your noble endeavors and your pure intentions.
It was touching to find this.
There's a thing that people say about art, like art gives you something you didn't know you needed. And it was like, yeah, I didn't know I needed that. And it made me so happy. I felt very good about my gender. You know, it just was thrilling to think like another wall is tumbling down. And it was a wall that I wasn't quite aware of, but it's the big wall. You know, like what else is there? What else are we going to discover now that this has happened?
That was New York Times art critic Roberta Smith. And back in the Guggenheim's Rotunda, visitors echoed her sentiment.
I mean, it's of course so amazing how we all thought we knew the history of art, but here is this woman from Sweden that we haven't heard of, and it's thrilling, actually, to learn.
People saying, like, she's kind of like deconstructing the canon, right, and like kind of recontextualizing what we think we know. But she's also like, it's also, that's not her project necessarily. Like, she's just so deeply personal in each of her pieces. And that's what's truly inspiring, is that both of those things can be true.
This is one of the greatest shows I've seen in my life, you know. I've seen a lot.
So maybe Hilma was right. This is her audience. And her story, it starts now.
That's Studio 360's Lauren Hansen. Hilma af Klint, Paintings for the Future, is up at the Guggenheim Museum in New York until April 23rd. Go. The Sarah Kirkland Snyder music you heard was performed live at the Guggenheim by the Vox Vocal Ensemble. And the excerpts from Christine Bergen's book, Hilma af Klint, Notes and Methods, were read by Sarah Singh.